Let me tell a story afterwards. Yeah. Somebody was asking about something here.
Yeah, I want to... I wanted to ask you a question about getting into your mantra. You said like you should make your mantra the root behind all your other thoughts.
And
make
it, yeah. Yeah, and if you don't like it, what do you do?
Yeah, what do you do?
If I don't like the mantra.
But you still want to use it.
If I don't like the mantra but still want to use it. We all get caught in this business sometime or other. Maybe in our what is called yoga practice, or maybe in life itself, in living itself. Whoever created this world didn't really consult us. If he had, we would have told him exactly what to do and what not to do. Or I don't know even about that, because it is summer and it's hot, and you say, oh, it's hot. Or by the time the message reaches up there, and then he sends some showers, it's mucky. And then you say, no, the heat and the humidity is no good. It's something cool. And then the cool weather comes, it's, cold. You, by the time it gets to you, you have already changed your mind. By the time the thing that you pray for reaches you, you have already changed your mind. So probably even that won't work. We are caught in this all the time, that we are made to do that which we rather not do. We may not be really, dead against it. If we are totally against it, I will tell you, you will go mad. Yes? Or depression. That's it, I don't want to do it. It's only the manner of your gut level personality saying, I will not do it. Let the world go to dogs. But most of the time, we do what we wish we didn't have to do. How does one deal with that? I think if we jolly well go to the bathroom or look into the mirror and say, all right, you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. Who was it? Paper for yesterday in Vancouver. Well, from Delta, I was being driven to the airport. Mrs. K stopped at a filling station, a gas station, and asked the attendant, who was a friend of her son's, do you like it here? He said, no. But I like the paycheck. I don't like the work, but I sure like the check. So, you're looking, you don't want to do it, don't do it. And here she says, well, I like the cake that comes after it. Right, sure. You like the cake, you like the check, yes? Yeah. Right then, the work that you do is the icing for the cake. Is that right? And you say yes. That's all. Why must I look at this work at all? I'm not doing the work because I want to do the work. I like what comes after it. But since that comes only after this, it cannot be made to come before, unless you pick somebody's pocket. It cannot be made to come before. And therefore, I am not doing the work at all, I am doing that. we are not talking philosophy here. We are talking plain common sense, brutal common sense. If you examine your life in this way, it's possible to resolve at least 60% of the problems that arise. Then it is possible slowly to fall in love with the work that you do. Not only with the paycheck, but also with the work. After all, it is nice. This is the thing that brings that. The husband is not so such a nice fellow, but the child is good. I love the child. Well, I think he is also a nice guy. Slowly you get reconciled to that also. And maybe in course of time you begin to see the work itself in its other aspects, and the resistance slowly wears out or drops away. I think for once both of us may agree here that it is better not to It is better not to do things in a state of tension. Half your heart liking, half your heart disliking, half your heart liking. Reconcile, make up that conflict one way or the other. I have a very simple cliche for that. If you cannot do what you love, love what you do. If you cannot do what you love what you do. That's quite simple. Now, again, the mantra can teach me that. The mantra and the way I use it can teach me how to do that. What is this mantra? Mumbo jumbo. Right? Then I suddenly see that even mumbo jumbo can help me. Jumbo jumbo, mumbo jumbo. Immediately I discover it is not the mumbo jumbo that matters, it is that which it brings about, a certain one-pointedness of mind, a certain introversion of the mind, a certain calming of the mind, and why not? I wasn't interested in the mumbo jumbo to begin with. But if I enter into it saying, I don't like this mantra because this Swami said, say it, I am saying it. And then one of these days, along with the mantra, you throw the Swami also into the lake and go somewhere else. I must immediately see that it brings some immediate result, not a distant result. If I do not like what I am doing now, and there is an unresolved conflict now itself, it can never lead me to a right path, no. That conflict must be resolved one way or the other. And once that conflict is resolved, I take off. Possibly with the wrong motive, possibly with the not so idealistic, in a not so idealistic way. But I have taken off in one hole at the gut level. That's the idea. Till something happens at the gut level, you are never whole. Either you are thinking or you are feeling. Thought or emotion can never integrate your personality, only at the gut level. That is, when the thought and the emotion merge and drop down, then life goes on, action takes place. So is it possible for me? I must see, since there is a doubt, there is a question. I am not interested in this. Must I still repeat this mantra? It is at the intellectual level. And at the intellectual level, I must supply a counter argument. Yeah, when I repeat the mantra, I can play with it, I can make use of it. It's not all that the textbook says, that if I repeat the mantra, God comes and jumps in front of me. Maybe, may not be. But immediately I can work with it, use it as a tool, and see that I am not a fool. Use it as a tool, and see I am not a fool. How can I do that? I invent some conundrums, some puzzles. What is this mantra? Doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter what the spiritual or esoteric significance of the mantra is. Let's see, his apple joke. That's the most interesting thing, right? Ah, right. Why do you look for the esoteric significance of the mantra or what the subconscious mind is doing? Look at the apple is green. What is the color inside? Inside it has no color at all. But the apple is green. When I cut it, that becomes outside. Let it come, let that happen. Let me take a bite and then see. Let me take a bite. When I take the bite, I bite only the outside, the green, what is easily visible to me. And if the mantra has an esoteric significance or subconscious value, let that become surface. Let it come up. I'll see. And so instead of anticipating something, I suffer now in order that I may enjoy somewhere else. I don't know. I shock some very religious people. You know, when someone says, go on suffering here so that you may have eternal life or you may enjoy in heaven, I feel there is a snag in that argument. If I go on suffering now, I'm used to this suffering, to this pain, to this sorrow, to this grief, and to this suffering. And if I go to heaven, I'll miss my
swallowing.
I'll miss my here, exactly.
Comfortable
suffering. I'll feel quite
I'm used to it.
Fish out of water, yes. And so once again I suffer there. I'm used to the suffering here. Just as one lady said here, right here. She couldn't sleep the first night because it was quiet. It was so quiet, she said, it's frightening. So I may be so used to this suffering and misery that when I go to heaven with all its enjoyments, I may feel miserable again. So who wants all that? I'm here and now, immediately the mantra must solve my problem. And does it have that value? Does it have that power? Yes, I must discover it and use it now, at once. Then you will like it. You wouldn't fall in love with it now, true. Then you will begin to like it. And once you like it and use it, and if while using it, you are able to discover some value, now, not in the distant future, now, here and now, then slowly the mind says, my God, I didn't look at it this way, I didn't look at it that way. If you go with only a single notion concerning a mantra, that if I repeat this honestly and faithfully and sincerely and wholeheartedly now, God will come and catch hold of my children, the pigtail, and lift me up to heaven. Well, somewhere along the line, you grow bald. And then you end up, now that they have lost their pigtail, maybe it's useless repeating the mantra. So forget all that. When I start repeating the mantra, it must already produce a gut level action, not reaction, action, which shows me how to use it. And what it is meant to do. And so I suggest to myself a tremendously simple and common sense approach to it. I don't know if it is going to lead me to God or God realization or self-knowledge or bring me success, health, long life. I may not even want it. I'm only interested in this. What exactly do I mean when I say I'm mentally repeating a mantra? Who is repeating it? What is repeating it? Where is the sound heard? And what is it? You are seeing your own thought for some time, and then quite possibly you will begin to see what you mistook to be yourself. Yeah, we are also saying as we are walking away, if anything is unclear in the morning discussions and so on, please come up with it, because some of us have been here together for quite some time, maybe 8 or 9 weeks. So sometimes when I look at someone and I find that there is an indication of understanding, I go on. It may not be quite clear to newcomers. Yeah.
You mentioned this morning that there's a difference between outer knowledge and inner knowledge, or self-knowledge, or the knowledge of self, or knowledge from... What part does outer knowledge play in arriving at knowledge? You have a great deal of outer knowledge and use it quite extensively. How important is this to arriving at knowledge?
Ah.
Or is it only used after knowledge is arrived at?
How important is it in arriving at knowledge? How important is outer knowledge in arriving at knowledge? Bluntly, it is an obstacle. It's a bit too blunt, I guess. It is an obstacle. But since it is there already, and we become aware of it when we become aware of the whole problem of knowledge, that which is really an obstacle may be used as a stepping stone, as a diving board. as the first step. One great sage is said to have remarked that self-realization was easy for me because I didn't go to school. I didn't read anything. You and I, we learn this only after having gone to school, yes? I have to read that book. And in order to read that book, I must have gone to school and finished my schooling. And then I pick up this book, and suddenly the book says, it should have been much better not to have gone to school at all. It's too late. So, since I start from there, I must learn to question. And as a question, the quest begins. That is why it is the first part of the word question. Question is not for its own sake. Question is a quest. And in order to question, there should be something which should trigger that question. And the external knowledge or outer knowledge is the trigger for this question to arise. And that question starts off a quest, which either points to a factor which is hidden even in this outer knowledge, or transcends it, which both of them mean the same thing. What is called the outer knowledge is not outer. It is the nature of the mind, that's what we are told, and that is the truism we begin with. That the mind by nature becomes aware of object. Till we discover that it is the mind's urge to experience that is the object, that creates the object. It is the mind's own urge to experience its own hidden potentialities or latent potentialities or natural potentialities. It is that urge itself that creates what is known as an experience, which stands as the object in relation to oneself, which is the subject. So, the outer knowledge can, what is called the outer knowledge to begin with, can be used as a diving board to dive within, then to discover that there is really no outer inner knowledge, knowledge is knowledge. And that the urge to experience, when it flows through the sense called sight and the eyeballs, creates colors, form. When the same urge flows through the sense of hearing and the ear, sounds are heard. When the same urge flows through the brain cells, stimulating them, concepts are formed. Whereas this merely the colors are seen, the whatever that is, fluffy, and reddish brown, black, yellow, light green, brown. That's all the urge that flows through the sense of sight and the eyeballs apprehends. The urge is then transferred into the brain cells, into the mind, and awakens memory, concept. And this is the lady. Having come up to that level, the quest continues within oneself. How are concepts formed? How are impressions received? And ultimately, what is the content of what I have been calling a mind, what I have been calling a thought, what I have been calling an emotion, a feeling, or knowledge, or sense experience? What is the content of all this, and therefore, what is the ground of all this?
And ultimately, this realization of the knowledge or the self seems to be dependent somewhat on a level of understanding which is always intellectual.
Oh, no. No. Not at all. That's unfortunately a basic fallacy.
Even though the ultimate thing is a gut reaction.
Right.
To lead us to that point, it's an intellectual concept.
The gut reaction always comes and challenges the intellect and the emotion. It says, I don't want words, I want that. I don't want words. I don't want words. I don't want mere experiences, the emotional level. I don't want what is commonly termed as experience, the experience of seeing, the experience of hearing. No. What is pure experiencing? The experiencing that you and I had when we were fast asleep. That was also an experience where the subject-object relationship did not exist. This thing did not exist. I'm pinching myself. Here, there is an experiencing in which I is there and pinching is there. The I being the subject and this feeling or whatever it is being the object. In sleep, there was pure experiencing without a subject and sleep as an object. Can looking then also become undivided experiencing, not undivided experience, undivided experiencing? It's a semantic problem. It is a semantic problem, I guess.
When you say the chela must be on the same level as the guru, in a sense, you're not talking about level of understanding
as much as space
or...
Thank you. That is why... Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. It's another wordless communication. Thank you. It is not a level of understanding, obviously, just for your amusement. There is no level of understanding. Understanding demands two different levels, no? You cannot both stand on the same level and understand. So one has to stand under. Right.
Is it possible for two people to understand each other?
Yes. Yeah. What is needed, therefore, is affection between the disciple and the guru. Tremendous affection. And hence again they insisted upon what is called Guru Bhakti, devotion to the Guru. Only with my ears, with my brain. What does the brain do? The brain merely picks up those words and it has a built-in computer mechanism. So that the moment a word is received, it's connected with all the data that have already been loaded into the computer. That's it. And for every new suggestion that is received from the teacher, there is either the yes response or a no response. It's no use at all. Listening intellectually to a master is absurd, it's a waste of time. Because if you have done that, and if you go back home, you either go back thoroughly disillusioned. I thought this is a clever man, he's made a fool of himself. He's talking rot. Or you go, wasn't he marvelous, fantastic. I couldn't understand a thing. That is the emotional response. And even on the intellectual level, there is another. He was absolutely right. Means, he said exactly what I wanted to hear. Why did you have to come here at all? You stayed at home. If you wanted him to say what you want, you know already. So, either there is an S response, which is obviously a waste of time, going to a master and waiting for him to confirm your views, it's a waste of time. And if he says something which the intellect does not approve of, you're going to reject it, he's a fool. And even the emotional response is useless. Either you are going to say, what a fantastic man, I didn't understand a thing, but he was a gorgeous person. Look at his beard, look at his eyes. A waste of time again. It is when when the intellect drops into the heart, which means the coil is, and there is a gut level devotion. Not mere sentimental, you know, what is associated with emotion. Devotion, depth, in depth, gut level devotion. Then the master and the disciple are on the same wavelength.
I can understand that as the divine in you and
divine in him.
In him, yeah. Why learn and transmit all of this knowledge? And then, is it to attract certain types of people, or what is the purpose of?
No purpose at all.
There would be other ways of approaching.
Oh yes, yes, actually.
Would this be considered a Western approach then?
Which sir?
Transmission of knowledge. Is
I don't know. I think it is universal approach. And I think I used the word transmission once or twice in the morning at now, it's really awakening, it's not transmission as such. Because the master, even when he transmits his energy or whatever one would like to call it, it is merely to remove the obstacles. Because self-knowledge does not demand anything to be injected. The self is there. There is probably a cloud of confusion. There is probably a cloud of confusion, and all that the master's energy does is to blow that cloud away. And I see the light of truth in myself. Or the self is real. The doubt concerning that is blown off.
Seeing that the self is real is intellectual concept?
I cannot see that the self is real, because the seer is the self.
It sounds like you keep chasing it.
Right, correct, exactly, right. So, all that is possible is to remove the confusion concerning the self. This is my hand, and yet if she steps on it, I say, I am hurt. There is an obvious confusion here. Either it is my hand, or it is I. This is I. And with this confusion, I go to the master, tell me, what is this? Is this supposed to be my hand or is it me? When she steps on it, shall I howl, she is stepping on my hand or she is stepping on me? And if you say it is only my hand, it is not me, then I ask you, tell me what me is. These are my legs, these are my arms, this is my head, this is my neck, this is my body, my chest and my abdomen. She can step on each one of those things without stepping on me. Please tell me what, how to overcome this confusion. With this I go to the Guru. With this confusion I go to the Guru, I go to the Master. And the Master merely enables me to see that there is a confusion. When the confusion is seen as a confusion, it is no longer a confusion. That's it.
I've got a question. It's about Swami Mukhananda. He talks about the blue pearl a lot, and that is the ultimate. He asks people, he says, unless you've seen the blue pearl, then you haven't reached cosmic consciousness or God realization. Now I was wondering if that is the same for everyone, this vision is the same. It has to be the same.
It is the same, not have to be the same. It eventually amounts to the same. The blue pearl, I think that's something which he developed here, or his translator developed here. It's the bindu, it's the point from which everything originates. The Yoga Sutras mention this as Murdha Jyotishi Siddha Darshanam. One of the chapters she accuses me of having skipped completely. All right, one sutra is explained now. If one does, if one becomes proficient in dharana, dhyana and samadhi, that is concentration, meditation and samadhi, when one becomes absolutely proficient in that, tasya bhumishu vinyoga, the three are called together called trayam ekatra samyamaha, the three are called together are called samyama, and this discipline samyama can be applied or directed to various fields of observation. Bhumishu. Tasya bhumishu vinyoga. And when this concentration, meditation and samadhi, you must first become proficient in the whole thing. And then retain the ego sense. The I-ness. And then direct it in one direction or another. Murdha Jyotishi Siddha Darshanam. If you become proficient in concentration, meditation and samadhi together, and direct this three-in-one inner discipline to the light on the crown of your head, which means after the kundalini is awakened and taken chakra by chakra into the sahasrara, and you are able to direct it to the topmost center of your consciousness, then you will have vision of the siddhas, of the perfected ones, of the sages, enlightened beings. That's what he calls the blue pearl, where you will see, you will meet, you will see the celestials and the perfected sages. What you can have, you can see Jesus Christ, Buddha, Krishna, whoever you want. It is considered Murdha Jyotishi, that's the light that shines at the crown of your head. And of course, he started using blue pearl here. That's very expressive and beautiful. The next part is mentioned in Gheranda Samhita, one of the Hatha Yoga scriptures, that one who is proficient in having the vision of this blue pearl, the crown of his head, can then project it outside through the eye, usually the right eye, and see it outside. Well, at that stage, I suppose you have lost all consciousness of inside, outside. And in that you can also have a vision of the object of your meditation, and that can again be a guide, lamp unto my feet. Thank you, because that is one of the psychic business mentioned in the third section of the sutras, which is sensible. It's nice. The rest is all how to read other people's thoughts and what to do. That one is good, very good. But in a way, I think Patanjali regards even that as sort of distraction. If I am, this can happen. This seeing of the blue pearl can happen spontaneously, which is nice. But if I am going to struggle hard to attain concentration, to attain meditation and to reach samadhi, why must I go on wasting all that talent into finding Chandra Samime Chara Vyuho Jnanam? If I go on meditating upon the moon, I get knowledge of the stellar system. What for? I'm not interested in that. But that one sutra is very good. Moodha Jyotishi Siddha Darshan.
When you spoke of visions, there are some people that feel they have visions, and some of these people are in mental institutions,
right,
and others are called, you know, saints.
Saints. It's only tossing of the coin.
Beg your pardon?
You toss a coin. And see and find out if he's an enlightened person or a bad person. And very often the wrong one may be framed there in the time.
if you work with people that are in mental institutions, or you come in contact, and they, then what would be your approach to them in a helpful way?
It's not easy, madam. In the present setup of the world, it's not easy at all. When constantly we are told this is the norm, and anyone who doesn't fit into it is abnormal. I don't think it's a very easy problem. And I don't think there's an easy solution to it. You can help them. If you encourage them, then they're going to get worse. If you discourage them, then you are probably doing a disservice. Personally, I wouldn't send them to a mental institution unless they are antisocial, right? They are violent, things like that. And if it is a truly spiritual experience, that person has no business to be violent and disruptive, antisocial. He or she may, you know, throw off into clothes or things like that. That's their business. That's a very serious social problem.
More and more young people seem to have this experience of the younger generation and one below me. Many, I come in contact with many young people that are feeling their hand.
I do not, personally, I'm not fond of these experiences. Mm-hmm. There is a tradition amongst yoga teachers and practitioners in India that if you have an experience, you should not reveal it except to your guru or something like that. Which helped in a way that if this young man had an experience, he didn't talk to us about it, so that he wasn't taken to a psychiatric doctor in the clinic. And he told it to his guru, and he gave the appropriate guidance.